Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Struggle Session. I'm Leslie the Third.
I'm Jack Allison.
And today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite writers. He's a writer of strange, weird, gothic, Lovecraftian fiction. He's kind of a mysterious character. Who writes, you know, some wonderfully dark stuff. Thomas Ligotti is what we're talking about today. People have been asking me about this episode for a while because I'm always name dropping Ligotti, mentioning him, and because I just, you know, love his style and his work so much. I highly recommend checking him out. There'll be some links to some short stories in the show notes of this episode. We're going to talk about three stories in particular today.
What do you mean, though, about how he's a mysterious guy? What is the mystery behind Thomas Ligotti?
Well, it is just he doesn't do a ton of, like, interviews or gotcha. Or press. Like, you know,
so he's, like, cool. He's not, like, a sellout.
Yeah. Okay, sweet. Yeah, like, you're not going to find him on, you know, random podcasts or anything. I would love to have him as a guest, but... And is also part of what makes Thomas Ligotti kind of weird, because he writes philosophy too, not just, you know, these dark, depressing horror stories. If you watch the first season of True Detective, all the philosophical stuff that Russ Cole says about how consciousness is like a crime, and the antinatalist stuff, and like how the best thing that could be is for you to not exist, existence itself being a curse and a punishment of unspeakable horror. That's all from Thomas Ligotti's specific philosophy.
Wow. So one other thing gets taken from what's his name, the writer of True Detective.
Nick Pizzolatto.
Nick Pizzolatto. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, he's a really fantastic writer. I would recommend his, you know, his novel Galveston. I think he did a great job on True Detective. So there was controversy in like the weird fiction community where they got mad at Rusk at the way the show used Thomas Ligotti's philosophy. Right. But I'm like thinking, like, you know, really, like, what the character in the show is someone who read the book by Thomas Ligotti.
Right. Well, it's also like it's different. It's like, you know. I mean, this guy's writing short stories and philosophy. Like, philosophy, that's fair game. Yeah. It's just philosophy for people to think.
Yeah, philosophy is fair game. Like, if Karl Marx was around alive today and someone in a TV show was a Marxist and said things that Marx said, I think that's kind of fair, yeah.
Right, just like if somebody showed up on a TV show as a Jordan Peterson guy.
Yeah.
That would be acceptable.
Yeah, that would not be plagiarism.
Anyway, getting back to it. Again. The three shorts we read. I've never read Thomas Ligotti before, and these were really fucking great stories.
Yeah. Thomas Ligotti has a style unlike anyone else. The three stories we read today are pretty good examples of that. We have The Red Tower, The Town Manager, and Our Temporary Supervisor. Now, I picked these three. They're kind of all kind of in little ways a little bit atypical of Thomas Ligotti. I think most of his stuff kind of fits into the typical Lovecraftian narrative. Maybe not most, but probably like half. And these three, like, one actually does not have like a narrative. It's not like a story. There's no characters. There's no plot.
Right.
The Red Tower doesn't have a plot. And the others are, you know, some of his more out there stories. But what links all three is that there's some very good, like, you can have a very good, like, Marxist or at least anti-capitalist reading of all three of these stories, which is not an uncommon theme in Thomas Ligotti's work. As I said, you know, he's not doing a ton of interviews lately, mm-hmm. but I think part of it is that he's from Detroit, Michigan, and every single story of his in some ways is about like a nightmare version of Detroit. And what he's talking about is, you know, the decay that happened after the economy collapsed in Detroit.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, just like from these three stories, like you know, it is. I mean, I think you can draw like a pretty clear parallel from all three to, like, you know, sort of like ruin and destruction under capitalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, elite control.
Yeah. So the first one, the Red Tower, This is the one with no characters and no plot. But Ligotti is just masterful at still creating something extremely engaging, very mm-hmm. creepy and scary, without any of that traditional storytelling stuff.
Yeah, I like. I feel like, and this was one. This doesn't have any characters in it, as you said, and it's like it's a little bit harder to sort of grasp and sort of like get your bearing in it. But it does paint such a weird picture. You know, it's like a sort of unsettling picture. And I found myself through this story like kind of feeling like, what's the reveal gonna be here? And it kind of like. There is not a reveal. It just like kind of paints a picture of like, you know, just like it just sort of paints a picture, I guess. I mean, to be honest with you, Leslie, like I read this story. The other two, I feel like I have a better grasp on. This one made me feel a little bit like a dumbass, to be honest with you.
you know, he is. He does, for lack of a better term, practice a sort of more literary style of horror fiction. So the Red Tower one is interesting. So it's basically someone who we don't really know describing this thing called the Red Tower, which actually isn't a tower, but at least in its current state of affairs, it's a factory that just produces these at first, you know, these weird
novelty
items that, you know, are mostly harmless, but some are kind of a little bit, you know, creepy. There's like a locket where you open and it's just a black abyss inside. There's like these vegetable things that if you touch them, they start screaming. There's a piece of sidewalk that for some reason, a piece of concrete that for some reason leaves like a green trail wherever it sits down, and it is completely inexplicable. And it's just describing all these, you know, sorts of, you know, nightmarish thing that the tower produces for seemingly no reason in this dilapidated part of the country. And they send out these items, and they talk about how they just show up in people's homes through subterranean tunnels, and some of them show up in people's like bodies, just all this weird shit that makes for seemingly no reason, but it gets distributed everywhere.
Yeah, no, this like, you know, and you're reading this kind of with the like, you know, I was reading this with the eye of like, okay, what am I taking about our real world from here or whatever? And it is very interesting, you know, this thought of like, you know, factories design, like, you know, purifying things that are taken from the earth and like doing this big process and sending them out on these sort of like, you know, trails across the United States so that they can end up, you know, like you said, like in the back of someone's closet, like in this in the Red Tower. You know, it is like these products are sort of produced just for the purpose of having them produced, and then they're delivered directly to the back of the closet where no one will ever find
them. Yeah, instead of being left on the doorstep first and then open.
Right. So, they just arrive where they end up.
Yeah.
And they're just as like perverse as any of the stuff that we like take on the doorstep and open.
Yeah. It's just it's basically, you know, it's like a metaphor for I forget when this
shoes. Fuck it. Like, I don't know.
Or just Amazon straight up too. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazon. Like gadget shit, you know what I mean? Just stuff, like just the stuff we fucking accumulate. And like, you know, this is a very good story for like, you know, number one, it just is creepy and sort of like gets at you and like feels weird to read. But then, yeah, it is also like, you know, it's Amazon, you know what I mean? Like, we're talking about like the great sort of industry that goes into getting something to the back of your closet unused.
Yeah, and so he mentions that at a certain point the Red Tower was attacked and all the machinery taken out, but then it moved all its workings underground to a sub-level where it produced what they call hyper-organisms, some kind of creepy creatures, Lovecraftian entities that, you know, unnameable things that cannot be described, and it kept producing those. And then there was, I think, yet another attack, and by the end of the story, the speculation is that the Red Tower, even though it seems to be dormant for now, now after these attacks on it, it's still there producing stuff and making stuff. Thing that kind of brings it home, this quote right here where he talks about how even, you know, though the tower seems, you know, defeated right now, people still find themselves, you know, talking about it. Here's a quote. Everything they are saying is about the Red Tower in one way or another, and about nothing else but the Red Tower. We are all talking and thinking about the Red Tower in our own degenerate way. Folks, that's just capitalism. Even if we attack it, even if we destroy it, even if we drive it underground or try to hide it, every problem we have,
it's still going to be there, putting shit in the back of our closet.
Yes. Yeah, I wait for them to reveal me. I wait for them to reveal to me the new ventures of the Red Tower as it proceeds right into even more corrupt phases of production.
Yeah, this is just capitalism. It's this invisible tower that makes products appear at your house and creates, like, you know, monstrosities and can't be stopped and just goes further and deeper underground where it can't be found.
Yeah. All right. And so the next story we have is one of his Thomas Ligai's more popular stories. And this one, if you want to hear it read instead of reading it yourself, there's a pretty good audiobook rendition of it on unofficial on YouTube. Officially, the only Thomas Ligai audiobooks are for his philosophy, or they're Italian, I believe. There were some in the Italian language audiobooks of his short stories.
So if you want to hear the audiobook of the shorts, learn Italian.
Yeah, you learn Italian.
And then, you know, get that one.
Or go on YouTube with some of the unofficial channels.
Sure.
But next up, we have... Yeah, but so the town manager, I really, you know, like this story. This is maybe one of the less scary Ligai stories, but still is, like, bizarre and weird.
It's bizarre. Yeah, well, it's scary in the sense of, like, how little control the people have, but it's not scary in, like, the traditional sense.
Yeah, so the town manager is about this town, and we're meant to believe that there's all sorts of towns like this across the United States, where there's this all-powerful town manager who basically comes and tells the people how to organize their lives and their town based on his whims. But the town manager is constantly going missing. The townspeople have to make sure that he's, you know, gone for sure. And then eventually, usually the next day, there's a new town manager with new edicts and new
rules. What I thought was so funny is that they also have to pretend to search for him.
Yeah.
They, like, knowing that they'll never find him and that this is just part of the process, they have to, like, pretend to search for the last town manager till the new one comes.
Yeah. And so we're at the start of the story, the old town manager has disappeared. We don't know where these town managers go, but we know they tend to disappear. And the new one shows up and it's creepy because there's no sign of how he got in or out of the of the town, and instead of working in the old office that the old town manager was in, like, he just moves into, like, a barn. It's mentioned that every time a new town manager comes, it used to be a really nice office place back in the day, and now it's just gotten worse and worse, and as the economy of the town has gotten worse and worse, and so now he works out of a barn. And basically, he just makes he's like the new town manager, you know, almost like a Pete Buttigiegian striver, all the town managers are. So he comes up with these public works projects to reorganize the town and drive business to the town and reshape everything. So all these townspeople, you know, every time the new town manager comes, their jobs change, their lives change, where they live changes.
All the town managers before, they all have, like, ostensibly, like, a big public works project.
Yeah.
So, like, one of them built, like, an opera house, like, it's like a library. And whenever the new town manager comes in, they're like, they always want to put their mark on the old town manager's thing. But this town manager, when he comes in, he wants them to destroy, what was it? It's like the monorail or
the
whatever?
The trolley.
The trolley. He wants them to destroy the trolley. And they're like, well, we don't think that, like, that seems good, and there wasn't a reason to do it. And then, like, the next day, he, like, the trolley manager is, like, dead and, like, burned into his chest is, like, destroy the trolley.
And the edicts that the new town manager sends out, Thomas Legaie, he uses, you know, this nightmare logic where the new town manager just writes it on a scrap of paper and it flies through the town and someone picks it up and they have to follow this edict. And so after they tear up the trolley, and they didn't need a trolley in the first place because the town isn't really that big. And and so after they strip it up, he sends them a note saying, you know, that we're going to change everything and your next year jobs will change. And so the town manager rebuilds the entire town into like this bizarro world with all these useless stores and shops in order to attract tourism.
One is like a maze of toilets he has them build that's like just floors and floors of non-functional bathrooms. The narrator's like friend ends up being in like a baby's crib and he like has to dress as an adult baby. Our narrator ends up serving gruel like deep in like back alleys. Like he's just serving like a soup like gruel or whatever and like figures that no one will ever come. But then people do start coming.
Yeah, people start doing like tourism in Funny Town because it's just a...
Yeah, the town manager rebrands it Funny Town. And then like people do start coming. And there is a bunch of new business coming to the town. Obviously now all the townspeople have to dress as like adult babies. And like nothing makes sense. And they're not allowed to like... And they like sleep at their jobs and shit like that. But, you know... Results matter.
It helps
Leslie.
The economy. If anybody who watches local news, you get this that sort of brain damage where no matter what the government is doing, if it's helping the economy, if it's boosting the economy, we're going to have slaves quarters next to the new stadium because that's the only jobs that will be available after it's built. But hey, it's boosting the economy.
It's boosting the economy, yeah.
Yeah, and eventually our narrator, the town drives up as these projects do. The tourists stop coming, and Funny Town is no longer any sort of useful. So our narrator, he decides to go ahead and leave the town. Yeah, he leaves, and while he's on the road at a diner, he's approached by someone, and they say, you got a lot of spunk. It looks like you might have what it takes to become a town manager. Yeah, so a very fun, story, horrifying in more of an existential way instead of, visceral way. But very good story. Next up, and the last story we read for this episode was Our Temporary Supervisor. And this is actually the first time I got to read this story, and I was really... blown away by it.
Yeah. Oh, that's wild. I didn't know this was gonna be your first time reading it. Yeah, no, this was like a very, very good story. Our Temporary Supervisor. So this one also takes place in ostensibly like a factory. I don't even think we ever find out exactly like what the factory makes, but it's just, mechanized.
Well, that's worth saying. So it takes place at a factory. It's narrated by someone who works at the factory. And he's always mentioned like what we do at the factory is we get these pieces of metal and we assemble them into this thing that whose purpose we don't know. We think we send it off to another factory where other people assemble it into yet a larger piece, object of some sort.
And then also, this is all taking place in like choir company or something like that, which is like another kind of very America-ish stand-in. You know what I mean? Like everything is sort of in supplication of like this choir enterprise or something like that.
Well, yeah, it's meant to be. It's almost like a company town, or at least the new version that's coming of the company town, where he mentions that, technically Quine Organization and My Nation are two separate entities, but you might as well think of them as the same thing, and us as citizens of this corporation. So this one, like the town manager, everybody's in the factory and their supervisor has to leave and gets replaced
Right.
Something else.
they can see it through frosted glass. Sometimes they see like an appendage coming out. You kind of can't tell what the fuck is in there.
But that's supposed to be the new manager, and like everybody's kind of freaked out, but they still continue working even though they don't know.
Which, by the way, I thought it was a very funny specific that this like weird deformed monster is like behind frosted glass. Was very funny to me.
Yeah. And eventually, but everyone's like kind of weirded out and afraid to like ask what's up with this, you know, new temporary supervisor, until this one quiet guy, like, just who hasn't been looking at the office, just says, fuck it, I'm tired of this, and he goes up to confront whatever that entity is, and it like tosses him around the room it tosses him around the room and throws him out of the office.
Yeah, he's like waving his hands around the air like bees are attacking him, and then he's thrown out of the office and he just stands there like stunned for a while, and then like the doors close up.
And after that, our narrator finds out that that guy who was tossed around, he eventually died later that night because he overdosed on the medication that is mentioned in the story that everyone in this town takes in order to...
Right. Everybody has to be on the medication, which is also like a subsidiary of this choir company.
Yeah.
And everything like that. So yeah, like, but they also do specifically say that he overdosed, but like, he's like, oh, but nobody knows whether like he was missing extra medicine. So it even is kind of weird, like, you know, whether he overdosed.
Well, the thing was, he had medicine left over, so he didn't just take everything. He was trying to just block out the day, and he accidentally took too much.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the next day they show up for work, and by the time all the factory workers get there, there's already a new guy replacing their co-worker that like just died. And this new guy, he is working, you know, so much better and faster and more efficiently than any of them can work, and they find themselves compelled to like try to match him and his movements. They don't even talk to him or get information from him, because when they ask, he just says, hey, actually, we have a lot of work to do, so why don't we get to it? Like, this guy who just comes from fucking nowhere as a replacement, and now everybody's
sent by the company. But then he like goes even further. So it's like during the first break, he like keeps going through his break. And then like lunch happens and he like eats his lunch with one hand while continuing to work with his other hand.
And it doesn't darkly inspires all the other coworkers like to do the same. Stop taking their breaks, continue working during their lunch break. And then by the end of the day, it mentions that the alarm bell that lets them all off duty sounds several hours after it is supposed to. And no one really fights this because whenever they ask questions about it, like they feel like nightmarish visions afflicting them if they ever like take their mind off their work.
Our guy, you know, approaches this new employee like while they're walking out from work and basically like asks him like, what the fuck, you're sent by the company, or more or less, right? And the guy's like, you don't want to like get into this, like this is just how it's gonna be now, pretty much.
Like,
and then our guy is like, are you gonna report me? And he's like, we don't need to report anyone anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's no longer necessary to report you. They already know what is going on. And geez, it continues like this. It mentions that, like basically they're not even leaving the factory anymore. They're just sleeping there, but they've never been more, productive. Of these objects that they do not understand the purpose of, whatsoever.
Yeah, completely alienated from, what the actual purpose is. And so our guy, like, finally does get fed up and decides to like resign from this job.
Yeah.
Like, he's at his apartment and he's like, I want to go resign. He has to go, like, he is too afraid to go do it in person. And so he has to go use like a common like phone at the end of the hallway. And it's even like, it seems like, you know, like this living situation is like very, very, you know, like it sucks. He's like has to squeeze through a tiny area to even like get to the phone or whatever. Yeah. And he finally gets there and he calls choir and he's like, I'd like to resign. And they're like, we're not accepting resignations right now.
They're not accepting resignations. You're not allowed to resign to this company. That's the only place to work at in the town. And he mentions that there's towns all over the country, like similarly, all over the world, similarly constructed, where there's one factory for everyone to work at. And he, and then the story kind of fast forward where he mentions that, you know, this is how things are. Like people just, you know, spend their entire lives at the factory. He kind of gives up hoping for a better life or doing something else, because what he's found is that the only time he isn't, you know, bombarded with, you know, dreadful nightmarish visions is when he is working and assembling these products, these small products, working at a furious pace, fitting together those small pieces of metal helps keep our minds off such things.
And, you know, how interesting that they're making them all take pills and stuff, too.
Yeah.
And they get, like, psychotic breaks when they're not working.
Yeah, and also there's even dark implication that even, because they also aren't accepting retirements anymore. So he mentioned...
Oh, yeah, they end up saying that, like, the resignation thing becomes policy, and then we're also not going to accept retirements.
And he mentions that, you know, we may eventually we'll be able to get out of this when we die, but then that also makes me wonder, like, what does the company have planned for me after I die?
Jesus. Good God. Yeah, this one's dark. This one is a very dark tale. A dark, predictive tale of why we have to elect Bernie Sanders.
Yes, more or less. Like, this is the future. This is the future if we keep going.
If under Bloomberg, this is definitely the future.
Oh.
Like, this is definitely the future.
Yeah, this might be optimistic because, you know, I mean, at least in this nightmarish future, like, the work actually brings them not joy, but, you know, distraction.
At least it, like, stops them from the nightmare for a little bit.
And, hey, they got health care, at least in this one.
That is true. They actually got health care. We would not be getting pills for free.
Yeah. Wow. Well, folks, that was Struggle Session. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Talk to you later.